Okay, we're running slightly late, but not too much, thank God. Okay, I'm Bulent Telerzad, director of the CSIS Turkey project. I'd like to welcome you to today's meeting with His Excellency Nabi Şensoy, Turkey's new ambassador to the U.S. The meeting is being co-hosted with the CSIS Europe program and the director of the Europe program and executive vice president, Robin Niblett, will kick off the meeting. All yours, Robin.
Thank you very much, Bulent, and thank you for helping pull this meeting together. I really wanted just to very briefly extend a word of welcome to the new ambassador. It's really a pleasure and honor to have you join us here today. Unfortunately, John Hamry has flown off to Seattle around about now. Otherwise, I know he would have liked to join you, but he's gone there to meet with the other big event taking place at the moment, which is the visit of President Hu. But the context here, as Bulent has laid it out, of the emerging triangular relationship of Turkey, Europe, and the United States, I think it's a triangular nature that we've been aware of for some time. Certainly Bulent and I have had the opportunity a number of occasions now to present jointly to meetings here at CSIS and elsewhere on, if not an emerging, certainly an existing triangular relationship. And I think there's nobody here in Washington, which is a city full of people who think strategically and think in policy terms, who have not tried to assess how Turkey's relationship with the European Union, what are the many potential ways that it will affect what has always been a very close U.S.-Turkish relationship. And I think both in terms of structural changes in Europe, the enlargement process has been going on for some time, but also in the more nearer term, some of the foreign policy challenges that have emerged in your orbit, south towards Iraq, as well as east towards the changes in Russia and the Caucasus. These are all dimensions that not only attest to the strategic importance of Turkey for both the United States and Europe, but also to the kind of impact it's likely to have on the transatlantic relationship. So it's very much in that vein that I'm very pleased that you would join us so early in your term here as ambassador. And I think on behalf of CSIS and all of our colleagues who've joined us here today, we'd like to welcome you and say thank you very much for coming here. And we look forward to your comments and to question and answer. But I'm going to turn it back to my good colleague Bulent and let him make the formal introductions. But welcome, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you. Well, you know, I won't call it a formal introduction. I was actually going to give a quick bio for our guest. But just to add a couple of words to what you just said about the emerging triangular relationship. On the one hand, Turkey is on the long track to accession, eventual accession to the European Union. At the same time, it has an alliance of five decades standing with the U.S. And the complex dynamics of this triangular relationship, as Robin said, is something that we're all looking at. And I'm also looking forward to hearing the ambassador, who served both in Washington and New York before, as well as in London and Madrid and Moscow, so he can deal with both aspects, the European and the American aspects of the relationship. Anyway, very quickly, quick background for those who do not know him. He's a graduate of the Faculty of Political Science at the University of Ankara, and in addition to his service at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in various posts, in Ankara. He was posted to New York, Caracas, Havana, and London, and Washington, as I said previously. In addition to also serving as an advisor to Prime Minister Turgut Özal, Ambassador Şensoy was Turkish ambassador in Madrid and Moscow. Immediately prior to assuming his current post in January, Ambassador Şensoy was deputy undersecretary at the foreign ministry in Ankara. Ambassador Şensoy, welcome to CSIS.
Congratulations. He got married recently and deserves a congratulations.
Well, I consider that that's the best thing I did in the last 3 months after my arrival here. So I wanted to mention that to you and make it public again. Thank you very much for your kind remarks. Thank you very much for inviting me to speak at this prestigious think tank. And thank you very much for feeling me at home because of your hospitality and because of the presence of so many Turkish journalists here. They've been saying that I have to really gather them together and have a sort of chat, which I had not a chance before. So I take that point of their presence here today. Well, I thank, of course, first and foremost, Mr. John Humphrey, who is very ably heading this very important think tank. And we were scheduled to meet before this meeting today, but he had to leave early, so I'm looking forward to the day that we will be able to come together. Thank you very much, Bülent Ali Rıza and Robin Niblett, for making it possible for me to come and address you on a very important issue, in fact, and a very important agenda item in the United States, in Europe, and in Turkey as well. And I'd like to make my presentation as short as possible because the topic deserves a lot of time to devote. But I'd like to have a more interactive dialogue with each and every one of you here. And that is why I'll try to be as brief as possible and make room for your questions. I'm going to take this issue in three sub-items. First, I'd like to discuss the Turkey-EU relationship. It's the actual situation in that relationship. And then, obviously, about Turkish-American relations. And I have had only 3 months behind me to speak about it. But I think I was involved enough in the past to be able to really talk about Turkish-American relations, not with the authority of an ambassador who spends years in this country, but with a person who has had some sort of insight to this relationship for a long time. And finally, a trilogy between Turkey, EU, or Europe, in fact, and the United States of America. Now, you're very knowledgeable, I know, about the recent past, and you're very knowledgeable about since the time Turkey showed the first time the interest to become part of the European Union. That was the year 1959. And in a few years' time, in 1963, we have entered into a contractual relationship with the EU by the signing of partnership agreement. And then it took us a long time before we could have another threshold to pass, and that was in 1995 when we signed the customs union with the European Union. And that was the first, I think, and it remains to be the first in the European, I think, acquis since Turkey was the first country to conclude a customs union with the European Union before actually becoming a member to the EU. Another landmark date was in 1999 when at the Helsinki Council meeting the EU decided to define Turkey as a candidate country. And in 2004, in December 17th, the most important decision was taken as far as Turkish-EU relationship was concerned, and that was the opening of negotiations with Turkey on 3rd October. And on that date, in 2005, we have actually started the negotiations. Now, Turkey is defined as an accession country. Since that time, since October last, there has been a screening going on the 35 chapters that are involved in our relationship with the EU. And out of that 35, 14 have already been successfully screened. And we do hope that during the presidency of the of Austria, which is the current president, we will be able to start at least in one chapter actual negotiations. And the most likely candidate is the chapter on science and research. Now, we all know this journey of more than 40 years has not been an easy ride for Turkey or for the EU either. Now, we have had our difficulties during that journey. And when looking forward, of course, one can imagine that it will be still a bumpy road until the day we're going to be able to be part of the EU as a full member. I don't want to go into the details of that bumpy road, because I'm sure you will be taking up this issue during the questions and answer period. So I'd like to just mention that there has been some talk as to the reaction of the Turkish people with regard to the decisions of either 17th of December 2004 and the 3rd of October of 2005. Now, it is true that the framework that was designed for Turkey to become a member is not something which would be wholly desirable by the Turkish people, nor by the Turkish leadership or the bureaucracy either. And people thought that because of that, Turkey has lost some sort of interest in tracking down the road to membership as fast as it did, as enthusiastically as it did before 2005. Now, I know for sure that the political will is there, it does not diminish, and it's not going to diminish in the future either, because I know the government, the Turkish government, as did the previous governments before them, have really set their eyes to the road of becoming a member of the EU. We're not mentioning time, we're not mentioning other things, but what we're saying is that remains to be the target, and we will do everything possible in our power to be successful in that quest. Now, when I talk about the Turkish will, of course, we have to talk about what's happening in the European Union itself as well, because this is not a one-sided road. Many people talk about Turkish obligations and what Turkey has to do and all that, and it's all relevant. But at the same time, it is not the end of the story. This is going to require the same kind of political will that is seen as seen in the Turkish side. So we know that the European Union is going through a time of reflection by virtue of the problems that the EU has faced within itself, in France, in the Netherlands, in possibly other countries as well. So we've been talking about the famous 3D of debate, dialogue, and discussion in the European Union. And in the words of Mr. Olli Rehn, the famous 3C, consolidation, conditionality, and communication. So these are very valid discussions. These are heated debate in the European Union. And we have to see the way the Union is going to describe itself in the future as well, because it all is not going to depend on Turkey. We're poised to do everything in our power to be able to participate in this great European project, But we need the clarification and the clarity of vision of the European Union itself. As far as I can see it, Turkey will be a very positive element within the EU. But the EU can either define itself as it is today, where you can have walls of Schengen around the EU geography, where you can enlarge the piece of cake that you have in front of you and have bigger slices. And this has really worked well for the European Union so far. But since now we have come to the point of defining a common foreign policy and security policy, now the Union has to think in broader terms, with a greater vision, if you will. So if the European Union defines itself as the way I did, then Turkey will have no place there. I can see that. And Turkey will not be, I think, interested in that kind of an EU, as far as I can see it. If the European Union decides, which I think it will, to have a longer vision of that beautiful European project in front of them and be poised to become a very effective international actor, then I think it has to really adapt itself to the realities of our day, and it has to have a policy which will embrace Turkey as part of their project. There, Turkey has a place, in my judgment, and that is where I think the EU should be headed. Because we know that wherever it happens, especially if it happens in places, in the geographies around Turkey, then no European country or Western country, we know now, is immune from the difficulties faced in those areas. And they are going to have eventually a bearing on the European Union itself and its individual countries. So that is why the European Union no longer has the luxury to say, well, we are surrounded by protective borders of Schengen and we can just flourish and we don't want to meddle with hotbeds, trouble areas around us or in the world. I don't think we have the luxury to do so because we are now faced with challenges that do not come directly from individual countries in many cases. They do come from the common threats as we describe them in terms of fighting against terrorism, fighting against the proliferation of WMDs, and fighting all sorts of trafficking. So having said this, of course, we can talk very easily about the positive dynamics of Turkey, which will be a very important input to the already developed mechanisms of the EU. Now, Turkey's economic performance, I'm sure you must have followed, has really peaked in the last 3-4 years. I don't want to go into the details with numbers and indicators, but everything suggests that with the exception of employment in Turkey, all the macroeconomic indicators show that Turkey is doing well, is in the right path, and it is achieving sustainable growth the stabilization program is working well. It has become the 20th largest economy in the world. It is the sixth fastest growing economy in the world. The GDP has doubled in a matter of few years. So if you take all these together, there are other numbers, but I, as I said, I don't want to swamp you with those indicators. But they all indicate that Turkey is doing very well as its economic performance is concerned. And it is no wonder that the EU has decided recently to qualify Turkey as a market economy, which, in my mind, I think Turkey deserved for a long time. But it has been admitted by the EU itself that Turkey is now a perfectly full-fledged market economy. Now, another aspect of Turkey which really helps a lot on the way to becoming a partner in the European Union is its reforms. Now, the reforms have been speeded up in the last 3-4 years, as you will recall. About one-third of the constitution has already been amended. And we have enacted 8 reform packages, or harmonization packages, if you will, which aligns our legislation with that of the EU. So that has been recognized also by the European Union, and that is why the European Union was able to qualify Turkey as an accession country, having met the Copenhagen political criteria in a satisfactory manner. And now, the other day, the Turkish foreign minister has announced the 9th package. The details I'm not going to enter into, but those who want to, my sharing with them that kind of information, I can do so. So when we're speaking about our relationship with the EU, as I said, it was a long journey with an uphill road, but at the same time we've come so close to being a member that Turkey will do its utmost in order to fulfill all the remaining obligations that emanates from being a negotiating country at this point. Now, a few words, of course, with regard to Turkey's relationship with the United States of America. Now, when I arrived about 3 months ago to the United States, everything looked good. I went to present the copy of my credentials to Dr. Rice, and she assured me that there is political will on the part of the United States administration to have a very strong partnership with Turkey, a strategic partnership, in fact. I know that we have the same will in Turkey. I've seen the president, the prime minister, all the ministers, including my own minister, and they all have that kind of strong will to maintain that kind of a relationship. And it gave me the impression that we have really put behind the tribulations of the 3rd of March 2003. Now, all of a sudden, since that time and now, we had 2 hiccups in our relationships. I would call them hiccups because they don't deserve to be called as real issues or problems. And you know what they are. Now, what troubles me most is not that these 2 hiccups have, in fact, taken place. It can happen in any kind of relationship, as strong as they may be. But the fact that it has happened in such a way that gave the impression that our relationship is going to be swayed from one side to the other again. And I am a strong believer in the strength of Turkish-American relations. It is strong because it is based on shared values, the contemporary values, which are common to the United States, to Europe, and to Turkey. And that is democracy, rule of law, respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms, and of course embracing a market economy, which we do. So we have to look into why two issues in the last 3 months have been sort of debated so long and so profoundly in either here or in my own country. And we have to look at the root causes of why this is happening. It doesn't take away anything from the strength of our relationship. We have our outlook very well defined by both countries. But at the same time, I feel it that as an ambassador here representing my country, I think we have to give a thought to why this is happening, and when it does happen, why has it the potential of affecting our relationship so much? And I think in this regard, I can address to all the prestigious think tanks in this country, of course, first and foremost the CSIS, to take up this issue and to look into that matter, I think. Turkish-American relationship is going to be, in my mind, in the future, from strength to strength. Last year, we had more than 30 visits both ways, and they were high-level visits, in fact. And this year, we have not started very strongly, but I think that we are going to reach the momentum that we had at least last year. And we do expect that Dr. Rice to pay a visit to Turkey before going to the NATO ministerial in Sofia in a week's time. And it was very unfortunate in my mind, and I think most of my colleagues here in the United States agree with me, that my minister could not come to the United States on the occasion of the ATC meeting two weeks ago. So this is going to be a tremendous occasion. I hope it will go through, and we will have the occasion of this high-level visit. And I know that both ministers do get very well, and they understand each other very well. So this is going to be a unique occasion to really to bring to the headlines that the Turkish-American relationship is alive and kicking. Now, a few words with regard to a trilateral relationship. And in that respect, I have already expounded my ideas on how the Turkish-EU relationship is waging towards full accession of Turkey to the EU. I have to mention at the same time that we are aligning our policies with that of the EU at the same time, not only our legislation, but our foreign policy and security policy at the same time. We do really subscribe ourselves to the common foreign policy and security policy of the European Union. And that is why we have always been a very strong supporter of the ESDP of the Union. And we are now aligning ourselves with the statements of the European Union, something like 90% of them. So we are now supporting the European position and aligning the foreign policy and security policy of Turkey in the order of 90%, and which is, I think, a high percentage if you take into account the degree of convergence of both sides' outlook in the past. Now, we can also talk about, of course, the convergence of the outlook and many political policy issues between the United States and the European Union. We know that the relationship has gone through some difficult moments, especially in the aftermath of the intervention in Iraq. Now, that has, of course, reflected itself in NATO as well. We've gone through that period. And when we invoked Article 4 of the Washington Treaty, the picture that was presented to us was not so pretty, and we would not be amused. But now we know that it is time to say bygones are bygones. As Turkey, as the European Union, as the United States of America, and I'm happy to note that since the visit of President Bush to Brussels, I think there is more convergence between the policies of the United States and Europe as well. So this is good news for Turkey because we have the excellent relations with both countries. I mean, you and the United States. So, for us, NATO is the backbone of transatlantic relations, and it has to be as strong as possible. And now I can see that there is better awareness, more awareness on all parts, and especially in the European Union, that we have to have the converging views of all important actors if we are to face successfully the challenges put forward in our modern day, be it in the Balkans, in the Middle East, in the Caucasus, in Central Asia, in the Black Sea, in the Mediterranean, wherever it is. We need this kind of converging outlooks and views. And that is why I'm very upbeat about the future of this trilogy of relations in the future. And if, and I hope more than an if, when Turkey becomes a full member in the EU, Turkey will be able to play a very, very positive role in this trilogy. If Britain today is the most strong link in transnational relations or transatlantic relations, we do hope that Turkey will be able to play one day the kind of role that Britain is playing today between the EU and the United States of America. And this is maybe, is it long enough?
Fine. We can pick
okay.
up we can pick up from there.
Well, we can pick up from there and hear what other colleagues have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. In view of the way you structured it, I think I'm going to pass on asking a question myself and give it directly to Robin, who might want to look at and examine and ask some questions on what you said with respect to the relationship with the EU, and then maybe I can pick it up before opening it up for questions.
I had a feeling a minute there that Bulan was going to leave me to ask one of his questions, but luckily he gave me enough latitude to think up on my own. Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador, for those comments, and I think you really laid out the three dimensions, obviously, that most interest us here, and I think that will lead to a lot of questions. I certainly have more than one of my own. But I will just throw maybe one up at the beginning. From the perspective of the relationship between Turkey and the EU, you pointed out, as I think we all know, this is going to be a long process. We're looking at 12, 10, 15, I don't know how many years. This will take time. In a democratic society, that means that a government that's in power now is probably not going to be the government that reaps the benefit of the strategy when it finally comes about. And as we all know from other examples, certainly of EU policymaking, governments find it very hard to take tough decisions when they don't know that they'll get to pay it, to receive the benefit themselves, and they're going to have to pass it on as a legacy to a future government. In that context, what are some of the toughest requests, as you see them, that the government's having to grapple with in terms of what it needs to do to get closer to the EU in terms of its membership negotiation, either ones that are on the table or that are likely to come on the table as the new chapters open up? Which are the ones that you think are going to be either most problematic or the ones that will need most area for work? Recognizing that, I think, as all of us know, a membership negotiation with the EU generally isn't a negotiation. It's generally how quickly or slowly does one adopt the EU acquis, and what sort of derogations can one obtain over time, either the EU or Turkey itself? And obviously, I don't know if this is a fair question to ask you, but I would be nonetheless very interested to hear from your perspective, and certainly for an American audience that maybe doesn't dig into these issues as much, from a political perspective, and that's what interests me. What are some of the tougher issues that you're dealing with right now?
Now, you're absolutely right when you say that these negotiations are not real negotiations. That there's a set of rules of one side to which you have to really align yourself as far as Turkey is concerned. And that is from a technical point of view. And we did hope, and we do hope, that our negotiations will follow the same track as it did in the past with regard to other candidates, which have already become EU members now. Now, what we're wary about is the kind of negotiations that are not technical nature. Yeah. And we don't want to enter into anything that will have political overtones. And this has not been the case in the EU in the past. It should not be in the future, not certainly in the case of Turkey. But then we're sort of faced with realities of our day, or facts of life, or sometimes, as they are called, solidarity between the EU members and things like that. If these things are introduced into our relationship, then I fear that this technical negotiations might be derailed in the long run. And that is my fear. And that is why any political issue which has nothing to do with these negotiations should not be introduced into this journey. And, you can identify a few of them. But as far as we are concerned, these are non-issues. But if they will be brought in front of us, as I said, because they're facts of life, then we obviously are going to deal with them. But the fact will remain that Turkey cannot do everything alone. It takes two to tango. So that is why we would hope that all the members of the EU will assume their responsibilities when it comes to sometimes circumventing difficulties or overcoming difficulties. And everything should not be expected of Turkey to overcome. As far as the problems, overcoming problems are concerned. So we can't do it all alone. We need the participation and the goodwill and the efforts of each and every member of the European Union if we are to succeed. We can't succeed alone. If everybody thinks that Turkey is going to give all the concessions that are asked of it by individual countries or the EU Commission, you know. And still, Turkey will do so. No, I'm sorry, that's not the case. Turkey is ready to pay a reasonable price, but not something that will satisfy all the requests, all the demands, and sometimes all the whims of every individual country.
Farman, do you want to follow up?
What I'll do then is to pick up on the U.S.-Turkish relationship. I'll come to the questions in a minute, but let me exercise my prerogative of asking the next question myself. Now, for over a decade now, from this particular chair, more often than not, rather than anywhere else in this building, we've been looking at the U.S.-Turkish relationship with its ups, with its downs. And the question of whether there is a strategic partnership, whether it's a strategic alliance, has been much discussed here. I don't know whether you had a chance to look at it, but the most recent update that we put out looks at the possible impact of an Iranian crisis on the U.S.-Turkish alliance. And that followed a piece that we put out 3 years ago, which looked at the likely impact of Iraq, which unfortunately proved to be correct. Now, you talked about the two hiccups without specifying them and asked the question, and it's a relevant one, what is wrong with the relationship that something as small as these, as you characterize them, hiccups, to use your word, would shake it? Well, the argument that is in the update is that, like in a troubled marriage, even small issues, and you've just got married, so maybe this is a wrong example, but anyway, I did use the example of a troubled marriage. Even small issues can come to the fore. Now, very quickly, the problem that I see, and I have articulated this in the past, is that during the period of the Cold War relationship, everybody knew what exactly the strategic partnership was all about. Since the Cold War ended, and you were with Mr. Özal as it ended, it was difficult to define exactly what the relationship was. It was more complicated. It was still relevant, but it was different. And my argument is that a decade on from the end of the Cold War, we still have not, either in Washington or in Ankara, come up with a satisfactory explanation of what the strategic partnership is. So if you are coming here, helps to contribute to that discussion, I think it's good. Now, you talked about the various areas where there could be the partnership, but let me ask you directly. If an Iran crisis comes, as we argued in the last update, and the U.S. and Turkey are not on the same wavelength for whatever reason, perfectly legitimate reasons, perfectly understandable reasons, what will that do to the relationship?
Well, before answering that last part of the question that's to do with Iran, may I take a moment, a few words, on how I see the changes have occurred in the last 15 years or so. Because we know that since the end of the Cold War, a new world is in the making. I don't know whether you feel that it has already emerged or not. I feel that it is in the process of still in the making. And we know it's a different world than it was in the post-Second World War. And even it is a different world since the end of the Cold War itself. So what's happening in the world is, in the international institutions, or as individual countries are concerned, we are all trying to adapt ourselves to the realities of our day. And this is happening at the United Nations. This is happening in the individual foreign policies of practically every country, and it is happening in the relationship between countries as well. Now, since the end of the Cold War, we all know that the United States has found itself in a very unique position, being a sole pole in the whole world. Now, it has brought with us the responsibilities and the challenges all over the world. So the United States rightfully is seeking partners who are sharing its outlook of the world, expansion of democracies all over the world, fighting against the asymmetric threats that I talked about before. And in that, the United States has a different set of problems and challenges. Now, Turkey's geopolitical position has also changed. Turkey, once a southeastern flank of NATO, has come from that position to that of being at the epicenter of a vast territory, starting from all the way from Europe to the Central Asian republics and even Afghanistan, which is traditionally called Eurasia. So Turkey has had its own shift in its geostrategic position as well. Now, it is just normal, as I said, since it is a changing world, we have to define sometimes also bilateral relationships. And it is not difficult for us to do that as far as Turkey and the United States is concerned, because, as I said, this has been a strong relationship. We have that kind of a great legacy behind us, with us, and we're talking the same language. We have the same goal. That's the most important thing. We have the communality of interests. And then, of course, in this changing world, in our own geopolitical positions, I think it is normal that we can also think about different avenues as to how best achieve the common goal that we have set in front of us. So this does mean a lot in our outlook to the problems of our area, because what is happening is happening at the threshold, at our borders. You can have another set of bilateral relations with any country in the Far East or somewhere in the West of Europe, and they will not be directly involved. The repercussions will be there, but not as much as it is on Turkey, because we have a historical background with these countries. We have a people-to-people affinity, sometimes cultural or historical, if you will. And then we have an ongoing interaction, political, societal, and most importantly, economic. We have trade relations with those countries. So when countries are evaluating the avenues that Turkey is following in order to get to that common goal, I think they have to take into consideration the particularities of Turkey into account. So I would like to really answer the same question, the question pertaining to Iran, with the same approach. We do hope that Turkey will be understood when it has a different approach to the same goal. You can note that in our relationship with Syria as well. You can even detect that kind of overtones in our policy with that of with Turkey and the Russian Federation. So what I can say is sometimes one party, one strategic partner may think of isolation of one individual country, and that's perfectly all right. That's the policy line which we do understand. But at the same time, where you're at the firing line, then you may follow a different road. And that is why Turkey is talking about more of engagement rather than isolation in certain aspects. And this does apply to some of the problems that we do live all together in our part of the world. And with regard to Iran, of course, if you take our approach from this vantage point, I think you will understand that there will be nuances in our policies. The objective is being there and intact. Now, with regard to Iran, It is not, of course, because of their policies in their nuclear program that brings all the difficulties that we're faced with today. You know, the United States of America is talking about the central bank of terrorist countries or terrorism when they talk about the terrorist activities of Iran. Also, the United States regret the fact that they're playing a very strong, sometimes repressive role in its immediate neighborhood, especially in the Gulf area. And the United States is also talking about the repressive tactics and the policies of the Iran administration, the government, the leadership, towards its own people. So it doesn't emanate from only one source, but it emanates from different sources, as it is put by the United States administration to the international community. Now, as far as the nuclear program is concerned, now, from the very start, we have acted along with the international community. In the first place, we said, if this program, as it does seem to be, is geared to weapons, nuclear weapons, acquiring these weapons, then it is going to be a threat to the international community. And Turkey, of course, will see it as a danger and sees it as a danger. So, in the first place, we don't want to see any nuclear power in our vicinity. That is the most fundamental of our principles as far as the area is concerned. But realities are realities. So, now, when the Iranians have conducted a clandestine program so far since 1984, as far as we know, then there must be something to it, and the United the international community is very much concerned about this, the intentions of the Irani leadership, and that is why we tell them very frankly to the Iranians that they have to convince the international community with transparency and clarity about the real intentions of this program. So far, we have aligned ourselves to the policies of the European community, the Union again. From the very start, we thought that this issue can best be settled by diplomatic ways. And that is why we did subscribe ourselves to the approach of the EU3. And when they wanted to have some kind of a dialogue and discussion and an understanding between Europe and Iran. And unfortunately, it has not really added up to much. And I think there the United States has played a very wise policy of letting the Europeans do everything in their power to convince the Iranians in diplomatic way. Now, it seems that it is not working, and the United States and the EU positions have now converged. And I think we can put Turkey safely in the same category. So whatever happens from now on, Turkey will still act as a very responsible member of the international community. Anything special on whether, you know, if sanctions are in place, whether those sanctions will be the result of resolutions from the United Nations Security Council, whether there will be armed intervention, whether there will be a coalition of countries, things like that. These are going to be, of course, a variety of questions which one may ask, but they will all be very speculative at this stage. Thank you.
Okay. Now, I have a lot of hands up, but they're all for the moment from Turkish journalists who I know are going to see the ambassador in a couple of days' time. So what I'm going to suggest is that, yes, indeed, I'll be happy to take the questions from our distinguished journalist friends, but to also allow the non-journalists to also ask questions who will not be at the press conference the other day. But Yasemin Çongar had her hand up first, and then Hasan Mesut Hazar.
Actually, thank you. The question I had in mind has been just answered by the ambassador. Maybe I could have a very quick follow-up on two points. One is, although you choose to refer to them as hiccups, being a journalist, I need to ask you, at the risk of sounding dumb, what the hiccups are. I think perhaps one is the Hamas visit and the other is the infamous movie. Maybe you could comment on those a little more than you did. And secondly, where you left your answer on Iran, you said this is one of the issues that we have been aligning ourselves, our policy, with that of the European Union. And I'm wondering if that will stay that way, especially if there would be sanctions that are not necessarily, the result of a UN resolution, but a transatlantic decision. Would Turkey go along with a transatlantic sanction policy toward Iran?
Well, I think I did mention this alternative as a speculative question during my last intervention, and I certainly don't want to go into the details of each possibility, and I don't think anybody would like to do that either. But all I can say is that we've been following the EU line, which progressively coincides with that of the United States of America, and we're very happy that it does. Now, what will happen in the future, I think it's so speculative that I would really go without answering that possibility, because, you know, it will usher in a lot of more questions, which we are not able to really address at this moment. But we will have to see what the developments are, how things unfold, before, even here in the United States of America, I think when I talk to my colleagues, you know, they don't want to go into the details. And understandably so, because there's so many variables involved that, every answer could be very misleading at this point. So we have to see what will happen, and all I can say is, we'd like to really touch base with the United States of America, with Europe, all the time, not only on this issue, but other issues as well. And as we have this heightened awareness of where we stand, as I said, that we can have different avenues to follow towards the same goal, I think there is a good chance that we are going to meet at a very high point.
Was she right on the two hiccups?
Yes, the two hiccups are self-evident, I think. And I hope that there's not more than that as far as hiccups are concerned. But, yes, please, go on.
Well, what I was going to say, the trouble with hiccups is that unless you get a shock or a fright, they don't come to an end.
So I'm just wondering how this is going to come to an end.
Well, I've tried that shock before. It didn't work, so.
Okay. Hasan Mesut Hazar, yeah. And then Beck.
Well, let me comment in two words, maybe, about the film and the Hamas issue. The film itself, I think, has coincided with a time in which the United States public, or certain segments of it, found itself in a very sensitive mood, I would say. If this film happened 15 years ago, I think, it wouldn't even make headlines, neither in Turkey nor here. Nobody would even mention it. But it did coincide with a very sensitive moment in the history of the American public, and that is why it's understandable. And I find that more understandable, because we've gone through that kind of a feeling when the Midnight Express was aired here in the United States and all over the world, and it has done tremendous damage to Turkish psyche and the Turkish image all around the world. So this is why I call this a hiccup, because it's not an issue. It is an issue because of the special mood that the American public, I think, find itself, and rightfully so. So this is all I can say on this point. On the Hamas issue, of course, it is something of the same different avenues. We thought that we would be useful in sort of a way if we told the Hamas leadership well in advance what is expected of them, not only as the international community, but as Turkey itself. If they wanted us, or they expected from us something different than that of the demands of the international community, that was the occasion to tell them, don't expect that to happen, because this is exactly what we said to the Hamas leadership, the three things that have been said by the United States, by the international community, nothing more, nothing less. So what is said here is most important and more important than anything else. Whether it did take place or not, it's not an issue as far as I can see it. But it did happen at this particular time, and it did coincide with the sensitivities of the American policies this time. But I don't find it a very, very crucial issue between Turkey and the United States, because people then argue that where's Turkey headed now? Is Turkey changing policy towards the Middle East, towards Israel, and so on? And nothing could be further away from the truth. So we have been in constant contact with the Israeli authorities from the very start. The foreign minister, Gül, talked to Ms. Livni on the phone before and after the visit, Hamas visit. We were in constant contact with the American colleagues here. We did not see eye to eye. They were not happy with the things, the way they unfolded. But we told them in a very transparent way what our thoughts were, and the important thing was the message that we were going to give. And it's exactly what we did.
Hassan Hazar, and then Secretary Jones. Go ahead, Hassan.
Could you please speak in the microphone?
Microphone, please. Yeah, it's being audio recorded, so I'd be grateful if you could do it. Thank you.
Mr. Ambassador, as you know, the Cyprus issue is the very important issue on the Turkey-EU-US relations. What is Turkey's expectation, specifically from the U.S., on Cyprus issue? What should be done? What can United States do on this issue?
All right. Well, I was expecting this from Ali Reza, of course. He's my good friend. But, you know, he knew you were going to ask the question. So, this issue is a perennial issue of Turkey with regard to our international relations. Everybody knows that Turkey wants to put this issue behind it because it has been taxing the Turkish foreign policy for so long. So I'm surprised sometimes those who do doubt about the intentions of Turkey with regard to the resolution of the Cyprus issue. And I think the referendums on both sides of Cyprus in 2004 have really revealed which side is actually the intransigent side. And being labeled so long as the intransigent part of the equation, you know, I think it was an eye-opener, the referendums were, for the international community. Now, the United States of America was involved and very active from the very start in the formulation of the Annan peace plan. And this peace plan was also supported by the EU itself. So the Annan plan was not only a plan of the Secretary General himself, but it was a plan of the United States of America and of the EU itself. So what happened then at the end is, of course, very surprising, because the side which said no to the Annan plan was simply rewarded by becoming a member of the EU. And the other side, the Turkish Cypriot side, is still being admonished and harmed by the continual policies of isolation. So in this regard, I think the United States of America has played a very positive role as far as the formulation of the Annan plan is concerned. Now, we still think that the United States of America is supporting the Annan plan. The plan is unfortunately not even being mentioned by the Greek Cypriot side, but it is still being mentioned as being on the table by many sides, and the United States of America is giving strong support to the Annan plan. So we're very thankful to the United States. Now, what are the expectations for the future? Well, I think that we do expect more forthcoming support from the EU countries, especially, and from all sides and the international community and Secretary General Annan himself for the proposal made by Abdullah Gül on the 24th of January this year for the lifting of all the restrictions by all the sides on the circulation of goods, people, and services. So this is a viable formula. This is a formula which is going to take us forward. This is a formula which should be implemented in the absence of an overall comprehensive solution. And we do hope that it will pave the way in the near future towards that goal. So we are very thankful on that score again to the United States administration for giving a strong support to these proposals.
Okay, so this is why I don't ask questions about Cyprus, because it blocks everything else out. Yeah, go ahead, Seda.
I'm curious about one thing. It's just the reality is that there's a serious deadlock today. Turkey is supposed to open up its seaports and airports by the end of this year. And if not, as Olli Rehn stated very clearly, we might face a train wreck in Turkish-EU relations. So how do you think that this deadlock will be solved and will not lead to any, freeze in this relationship?
Well, in the first place, this is not an issue that should really derail the negotiating process between Turkey and the EU. This is something that Turkey has to address itself along the process as we approach to the end. Now, I think it is a little bit unfair to think that in 2006, Turkey should be required to find a solution to this problem. And as I said, Turkey alone should not be asked to really find the remedy to all the ills of our relationship. We do need the participation and the goodwill of the EU countries at the same time. So this may not be an issue. And if it does become an issue, I think there are ways that we can circumvent this difficulty. And one of the best ways to address it is through the lifting of all the restrictions as formulated by the Turkish foreign minister. I think embracing that proposal alone is going to do away with all the difficulties that we can talk about in opening seas and seaports and airports.
Secretary Jones, Bo Miller, and then Ümit Engin, sorry. My apologies, Ümit Bey.
Can you get close to the microphone if possible, because we're recording. Thank you.
Mr. Ambassador, it's nice to see you here. I'm going to leave Cyprus, if I may, and talk about, you referred earlier to the relationship that Turkey has forged with the Central Asians and the Southern Caucasus. I think of it as a very strong leadership role. One of the areas that's of increasing importance, of course, is energy, particularly after the Russian action to cut off gas to Ukraine on the 1st of January. I wonder if, did Turkey share the alarm that the EU and the U.S. Shared at the time over Putin using gas as a political weapon, really, in his politics? And I wonder if you can talk about the conversation, the tone of the conversation that Turkey now has with Russia on energy matters, on Blue Stream, on Shah Deniz, on BTC, the kinds of issues that really could look to Russia as the kind of competition that we think is appropriate, but Russia may think is too much competition, and too much competition for their current monopoly.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. Well, first of all, the ringing of the alarm. I think, it was a kind of surprise to many, but everybody knew that the United States of America, Turkey, the EU has to have alternative energy resources to have a stable energy policy environment in place. Now, that is why it was something that individual countries were looking into the possibilities of in the first place. Well, of course, when Mr. Putin cut off gas to Ukraine, we knew the problems were there for a long time. And Turkey, unfortunately, was on the receiving end of this a tug of war between Russia and Ukraine for a long time. Our own gas was cut off at a very critical moment when I was ambassador in Russia. And people were freezing in Turkey because of that. So we knew the dangers that are involved in really putting all your eggs in the same basket. And that is why everybody was looking into the possibilities of diversifying its energy resources. So everybody was really trying to do that. But it was another eye-opener. And I do think that it has expedited the plans in either the United States of America, in Europe, and in Turkey. And because of that, now we're talking more about the Trans-Caspian gas pipeline project, which has been in the back burner for a long time, or even has been shelved for a long time. Now we're looking into the possibilities of reviving that old project, which is, I think, an added resource for Europe. Now, Turkey has recently become, or is becoming fast, a hub as an energy corridor, which is going to carry the riches of the Caspian Sea and the Central Asian republics all the way to Europe. And this is going to provide an alternative and safe energy resource for the Europeans and the Western world in general. So Turkey is very happy to be able to play that role. On the other hand, we have our own energy needs, and we are trying to diversify our energy resources. And that is why we did have this so-called Blue Stream gas pipeline project from Russia to Turkey, which has the potential to carry 16 billion cubic meters of gas from Russia to Turkey, in addition to other gas lines, pipelines that we already have with. And that brings the level to 30 billion cubic meters with the Russian Federation. And people have criticized that because it means that about 66% to 70% of our energy resources are becoming dependent of Russia. But since we have the set of relationships which we worked out through the years in the last 15 years, especially in the economic and trade field, I think, we at that point thought that having a pipeline between Turkey and Russia would not in any way endanger our energy policies. And we do believe that that is the case. But we still are trying to diversify our sources. We do get, as you know, gas from Iran as well. We are going to have the Shah Deniz gas brought all the way to Erzurum. This is another very important project that we have between Azerbaijan and Turkey with the involvement of Georgia as well. And the BTC pipeline is going to be kicked off, I think, on the 13th of July, as far as I remember. So it's good news as well. And if the gas also comes to Erzurum this year, it's going to be doubly important. So these very important schemes are being realized and will be in place by the end of this year, I hope. Thank you.
We've got about 10 minutes, and there are three questions.
I yield to a non-journalist.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry you're sensitive about the subject, but I know you'd like to have your own access.
No, that's why I yield to a non-journalist.
All right. Okay. Bo Miller, and then, as he's yielded, Robin Niblett will wrap up. Go ahead.
Mr. Master, I teach at the Joint Military Intelligence College here in Washington, and my question goes back to this non-negotiation, as you described, between Turkey and the EU. And the question I have is, as part of your dialogue with your EU partners as you go through this process, both sides also have to manage their publics and their public's expectations, their public debate, and the question of who's giving what and getting what back in return. And I wonder, as part of the negotiation or as a parallel track, are you in dialogue with the other side in terms of those kinds of sensitivities, and what feel do you have for the Europeans' understanding of the challenges that you face?
Yes, this is a very relevant question, and you know, you can carry on with the negotiations, but you have to convince the public as to the merit of that of those ongoing negotiations. And it is an open secret that the European public in general is not very much convinced about the merits of Turkey's becoming a full member in the EU so far. And this is a huge challenge that we have to deal with, not only as Turkey, but with cooperation, in cooperation with the European governments. And we have to do that in each and every one of those countries, even if they are more, optimistic about it. And this is something that was lacking in our efforts, I think, common efforts with the EU, with the Commission, and as Turkey. And now we know the degree of importance of convincing the public to the importance of Turkey becoming a member of the EU. And there are now programs that are being taken between Turkey and the EU Commission and with the individual countries as to how to conduct the public diplomacy in order to turn, hopefully, the tide around, because the leadership can do so much. But then again, you know, especially after the referendums that took place and their results, now we have to be even more careful about how we deal with the public opinion, not only in the EU countries, but also in Turkey as well. And Turkey, in the eyes of many, has lost some kind of enthusiasm. And there is no doubt that during the decision taken on the 17th of December and 3rd of October, there was a lot of resentment going through the Turkish public opinion's mind. And it has come to the point of humiliation in the minds of some. So when, you know, there is this kind of public diplomacy challenge in front of you, you know, you have to take it very seriously, and we do take it seriously, and we're working on schemes in order to be able to overcome that difficulty.
Robin, I know, has the last question on NATO. Go ahead, Robin.
Maybe it's a slightly tortuous question, but I noticed your comments that the foreign policy positions that Turkey's been taking, as you said, are now aligned perhaps 90% with the EU foreign policy positions. And I think, you know, definitely struck me as a...
We're talking about the statements.
Yes, absolutely, statements, the general
yes.
approach. I'm not saying actions yeah. and so on, but that of course fits with the EU as well. Perhaps this also ties into your earlier comment that the US and Turkey don't have the same proximity and therefore don't always have the same sensitivity to foreign policy challenges in Turkey's neighborhood. And therefore, perhaps one might draw the inference that just as the EU is close to many of the same problems as Turkey is, it's a more natural alignment. You also said, however, that NATO remains the central part of the transatlantic relationship. So to get to my question, to what extent do you think that NATO is adapting to enable its adaptation to serve as a bridge between U.S. foreign policy aims and security aims and, let's say, Turkey, EU, European foreign policy and security aims? There's this sense that perhaps NATO has adapted reasonably well at a military level, but is finding it hard to do at a foreign policy level. But if you want to have this centrality of NATO as the bridge for the transatlantic relationship, and yet Turkey is finding itself getting pulled into a similar neighborhood perspective as the European countries, do you feel NATO is adapting sufficiently? What is Turkey's perspective on NATO's adaptation? If you could say a little bit about that, I think that would be very interesting, you know. Sorry.
Now, yes.
The last question, but
well, it's a very nice last question, in fact. And, well, as I said before, all the international institutions are trying to adapt themselves to the realities of our day. And NATO is no exception. NATO has been trying to do that in the life in the last 15 years or so, in fact, and even before that. So it has been... constant adaptation, starting with the Hormel Doctrine and all that. Now, in the last few years, of course, there is a more focused debate as to how best to achieve the kind of reform that is needed to tackle the challenges of our day, especially in view of the bitter experiences, in fact, of 2003. So since that time, I think NATO has been doing a lot of soul-searching at the same time and trying to reform itself in order to tackle those challenges. And I think it has done well enough, but we know the difficulties inherent in NATO itself. So we have to take things at stride, I think, and not expect things to happen very fast, because it won't happen. Mm-hmm. Now, this brings me to the issue of NATO-EU relations. And maybe that was one of the reasons why you wanted to mm-hmm. raise this question. And in that regard, I think Turkey has been involved in more ways than one. And you will recall that 3 years ago, the Nice implementation document was worked out between Turkey, EU, and the famous trilogy between the United States of America. And we did really do well. And at the end of the day, we have a fine document which has been both endorsed both by NATO and the EU. The difficulty there is that EU has a different language than that of NATO. And there, of course, we feel bound by only the language of NATO because we're in there and we're not in the EU yet. So we just cannot really think in terms of the EU document, but rather the NATO document is something which binds us as we are part of it. Yeah. So because of that discrepancy, there has been a lot of talk that NATO-EU strategic relationship is not going well. Now, what has been reduced? Well, I would have understood that if it were not reduced to the inclusion of southern Cyprus to the so-called strategic dialogue between EU and NATO, you know. And then I ask my colleagues, you know, what are we missing all as EU and NATO members if the southern Cypriots are not allowed to take part in any discussion, for example, on Darfur or Ukraine, you know. I just want to ask this question to all my colleagues. What do we lose? What have we lost so far? And what are we to lose in the future if they are not included because of this discrepancy in the wording of two letters exchanged? So that is why I think that we cannot really talk about NATO-EU strategic dialogue difficulties if it is reduced to this part, if it is reduced to this point, and which it is.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, I'd like to express our appreciation for Ambassador Shenzhen.